Hello, everybody, and welcome to the new episode of your new favorite irreverent podcast, Woodworking is Bullshit, where we explore the why of woodworking rather than the how. I'm your host, Paul Jasper, scientist by day, woodworker by night, and I'm joined by my two fabulous co-hosts. First up, he's an award-winning author for his New York Times best-selling book, 101 Poop Jokes to Tell Your Kids, Eric Curtis. And our other co-host, who has advanced degrees in just about everything, including herpetology, where she specialized in handling and husbandry of iguanas, Mary Sy.
All of the above is accurate. All of the above is 100% truthful.
It gets harder and harder to make it through the intro every week. It's brutal. Okay, so on that note, we always start with a question, as you know, and today's question is, let me center myself, is hustle culture detrimental? And I think we should start by defining hustle culture. And the reason I say we should define it first is because not everyone knows what it is. One of my friends who I asked this week was like, what's hustle culture? So hustle culture is defined as like sort of a hyper-competitive ideology that prioritizes hard work and long hours above all else to achieve your goals of money, fame, prestige, whatever, and thus happiness. I think you can approximate hustle culture into the phrase hustle and grind. I think we've all heard that. Hustle and grind. And I think, you know, typically when we think about that means foregoing vacations. That means foregoing time with friends. That means there's like no downtime to read and watch TV or nap, which we all love. And I think the idea is like when you're wasting time like that, your competitors are getting the edge on you, right? So you better hustle and grind, plan every minute of your day to maximize and squeeze out the productivity of your life. And there are, you know, quite a few people who have espoused this lifestyle over the years. Gary Vee is one of the more popular ones that I keep hearing about. And I actually have a quote from him explaining a bit about how he defines hustle. And he kind of talks like this, and he's real excited and real manic. And he's like, hey man, when you have a passion around something, you just got to squeeze every last bit of juice out of the orange. You just got to squeeze it. To me, hustle is maximizing the energy that you're putting into something. Hustle would be putting all your effort into achieving the goal at hand. And for me, that means making every minute count. Friday night didn't happen because I was hustling every minute. There's so much hustle in my day. There's no hanging out. There's no time. Hustle's putting it all on the line. Hustle's waking up one day, the day before you die, and realizing you gave it your all. Emotionally, executionally, you go all in. So that's that's how I would define hustle culture. And the question again is it detrimental or could it be reframed as a positive aspect? So with that, I'll turn it over to Eric.
Oh boy. Well, first of all, your impersonations, 10 out of 10, man.
I was going to say, I want to hear your impersonation of both Eric and me.
Oh, we'll get there. That's for the after show.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me like the way that we're defining hustle culture stems from a mindset of limited resources, right? Mm. And I think this is a key thing because we've all been, and I've heard you espouse the benefits of a flow state. We've all been there from time to time. We've all put, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours in the shop without thinking about it. And that is fundamentally different from the idea that if I don't do this, somebody else will best me at it. And so I want to start off by making sure that we understand that when we're talking about, is it detrimental? I think we need to limit this to saying like in I hate to say the classical definition because it's such a new term, right? But in the way that we understand it as a culture, is hustle culture forcing us to be paranoid to some extent about our success and judge ourselves against other people. For me, I do think that I hustle. I don't think that I grind, right? And I think it's important to separate those two because I
that's interesting.
As the only person of the three of us who owns and operates a small business, right? Full time, at least I should say. Yeah, I work a lot. I do. I mean, you guys, you do. You run small businesses, and I don't mean to denigrate that at all. But I do it for my livelihood. I do it to pay my mortgage and, you know, pay my grocery bills. And so I do work a lot, but that's the nature of the thing. But it's not, it doesn't stem from a mindset of if I don't land this client, somebody else will. I don't care if somebody else lands the clients. And there are times where I need to take a day off to go meander through the woods to find an idea if I'm developing an idea for a client. So do we define that as part of the hustle? Because it's work, but I'm not at work. I'm not producing quote unquote valuable content for clients. I'm off in the woods trying to figure out where an idea is going, right? So it's, I don't know. There's for me, putting in the hours is, it's not trying to take things from other people. It's knowing that I can't not do this thing that I love. And so I might as well just embrace that part of me and do the thing and be happy with it rather than hustle and grind. And I mean, if we're defining grind, like that's literally wearing a thing down. You're grinding away until it's non-existent anymore. And that's a really dumb way to go about running a business because it's not sustainable. So I guess that's my first question is like, what mindset are we, how are we defining the detriment of hustle culture? Is it detriment to our emotional and spiritual well-beings? Is it detriment to the creative process?
Is it detriment
to making beautiful objects? Where? What is that?
So I think, and Mary, you're going to go next because we haven't heard from you yet, but I think that hustle culture, sorry, the grind part, really. I love how you separated hustle from grind. I never thought to do that. That makes a lot of sense because we do have to hustle at times, and we do actually have to grind at times. I'll say, like, I feel like life is a series of like sprints and rests and endurance running. Like those three things are what typifies our life. And there's certain times when you have to sprint or you'll miss an opportunity. Like for me, the sprint was in graduate school for my PhD. It was a grind. It was hustle and grind for 7 years. And I knew it had to be that or I wouldn't finish with a degree. So that was like a time limited offer. So there are periods, I think, where the hustle and maybe grind is important. And then there's periods where like having a better balance of, say, some endurance running and some hustle or sorry, some sprints and some rests, you know, in balance can be beneficial. Now, in terms of the negatives, Eric, to answer your question, you said, what are some of the negatives? It's like, well, I think too much hustle and grind can kill your creativity and productivity because you're exhausted all the time. And you're not going to be creative and productive when you're exhausted. And I think it can ruin your health. The amount of stress and anxiety that comes with that lifestyle leads to huge amounts of stress hormone release like cortisol. And we know it depresses your immune system. It predisposes to all kinds of diseases. The third thing, which my friend John brought up as I was chatting with him, John Welch, as I was chatting with him about this, was that guilt. Every minute you're not hustling and grinding, you feel guilty that you're not. If you took a 4-hour nap, God damn it, I could have put that towards achieving this. And that guilt sticks with you, not just for the day, but for years. I think I still have some guilt left over from my grad school days about being productive all the time. And the last thing is I think we wind up sacrificing the things that are actually really important to us in the long run, which is time with friends, time with family, time with your, like, you know, alone time, like nature, like Eric, your cross-country drives in nature and all the things, you know, that lead to a well-balanced life. So those are four of the things I think are detrimental about this. And with that, you know, Mary, what do you think about this whole topic?
Can I ask real quick, like, where did you get that definition of hustle culture?
I made it up. No, no, like I did a bunch of reading and there's no exact definition, right? Everyone's got their own, it's just an approximation of sort of the cultural essence of it.
Okay. I was asking because you had said that it was like the first, I forget what the first thing you said, but it was something about like it being a competitive.
Yeah. Like hyper competitive ideology. That's what I said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me, I don't know if I compare myself to others in terms of like hustle. I'm mostly competing against myself. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of it's internal of just like, like the guilt part is huge for me. So like, I should be doing this. Like I was this productive, like some other day. And like, I should be at that same level as well. So for me, yes, I think I went through probably like a similar route in terms of going to school. Like I remember when I was an architect and making minimum wage, very little money, and like not knowing, you know, if I was going to eat the next week, and then deciding to go to grad school as a way to get over that. And knowing that if you suffer through grad school, the end result will hopefully be good. And that was the case for a lot of people. So yeah, I think for me, it is a lot more internal. It's more just kind of like, don't disappoint yourself and like, don't, I don't know, maybe it's too much like chastising of yourself and it's probably not healthy. In fact, I know that it's not healthy because in my low points, I definitely get a lot more depressed because I'm comparing myself to a past version of myself. So yeah, it's not great. But I also will say that in my mind, I try to hustle because I want to be in that state. And I think that I get a lot done. I don't know if that's always going to be the case, but
in what state do you mean?
Always working towards something and always having a goal to work towards. So, if I don't have a goal, then I feel like I'm stagnant and complacent. Mm-hmm. And if I do have a goal, I feel like I'm at least working towards something.
This is an interesting thing to me because I've long thought that having like making strides toward an end is more rewarding than the end itself. Right. And I know there's some psychological data to back this up, which I don't have on hand because I'm the only one of us with a bachelor's degree. So forgive me. but I do think that,
all right.
I capped out at a bachelor's degree. But I do think that like, this is where hustle culture becomes a little stickier to talk about and to define, right? Because you are giving people who may feel the ebb of not knowing what to do, you're giving them a tangible goal to work toward and then creating movement. And that may, like, some people may internalize that in a way that's unhealthy and take that to the extreme. But there is a subsegment of those people, and I think that I'm one of them, that can take that idea and turn it into momentum without letting it roll too far down the hill too fast, you know? Because I know that for me, like, if I'm in that same funk, I just need to get back in the shop. And sometimes like it's at a slower pace, it's less hours, like you need to give time and space. But I also know that it's a muscle memory thing. And if I can just get back in the shop and start doing a thing, it may catch on to something. Mm-hmm. And that spark may reignite. And that's the important thing. And so I don't know, like some folks might call that hustle or grind because you're doing a thing where you don't really know, it's kind of butting your head against the wall. But simultaneously, it's a searching mindset, right? Like it's a seeking mindset where you're like, I don't know what I'm looking for, but if I keep looking, I might find the spark that then pushes me down a new direction and down a new road.
I see. I want to ask both of you the next question, which is, were there times in your life where you felt like hustle and grind was like really important for that period of time? Like often it's when people are starting a new business. Mm-hmm. Or when they're in school, like, you know, fresh into a degree or, you know, or something along those lines. So for each of you, you know, was there a period when you felt like, yeah, it's time to hit the gas?
Yeah, for me, it was probably school is like one of the more significant ones because I knew that my health is probably going to decline because of how little sleep I'm getting and I'm not eating well. I'm not exercising. It's just overall not great, but I am working towards something in my academic career that will, you know, hopefully have a good outcome. And whether or not that's like another career, if that's like an academic goal that you had set, like publishing a paper, et cetera, that is probably the most significant time. I think like other times I can quote are, you know, when I first started my business and I wanted to get my name more out there, like I was pretty lax about it at first. And then I remember at one point I was like, all right, I actually got to start getting clients. So then I started reaching out and just like spending all of my free time being like, okay, how can I get more commissions? And that was like a version of a hustle, although to be fair, I have a full-time job, so I didn't feel that drive as much. But yeah, again, like I said, it's just like setting goals for yourself and reaching towards that.
Now, when you achieve those goals, and Eric, we're going to come to you, your periods of hustle and grind, but Mary, when you achieve those goals, do you feel different? Like when you have achieved it, are you like, yeah, that's it? Or is it more like, okay, that was interesting. Next goal. How do you?
A little bit of both, I would say. I think for grad school, I was really pleased with the outcome of my master's thesis. And then also just like moving into a new career. I was just relieved, I think, at that point. So I was really happy to move on and have reached that goal. But I am not someone who likes to sit still or be still for a while. So like as soon as I accomplish something, I am like, all right, next one.
But Mary, is that sitting still feeling an illusion? I mean, you're never really sitting still. But is do you need that goal to give you a sense of momentum?
Yeah, I think so. Like I always want to be working towards something. I feel like I'm moving forward in that sense.
I see. Eric? How was the period of hustle and grind for you? Was it starting your business when you transitioned out of teaching, or what was it for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I think that's the clearest example of, at least the most recent example that immediately came to mind when you said that is when I stopped teaching, it was 2021, the fall of 2021. We had finished shooting the Netflix show. It had not yet come out. And so I had to transition. I had to be available in case we got a season two.
Can you talk about, hey, sorry, not everyone knows the Netflix show. Can you just a brief summary?
I got a Netflix show. And that's Emmy what
happened. Award winning.
We did. I did win an Emmy. That was a funny thing that happened.
But and that's not a joke, by the way. This is legit. He won an Emmy.
I just ordered my statue yesterday. So that's coming now.
That's awesome.
So got a Netflix show randomly filmed while I was teaching, and then I had to be available for season two. And ultimately my boss and I decided we were like, we don't really want to like mutually, we didn't want to terminate the contract, but we also knew that that's where it was headed. So we walked away amicably, and I had to go start a business because there was no sense in me like trying to find a job and being like, hey, I might not be available for, you know, 3 months and I don't know. And so there was this moment of, I don't know if I can do this or I don't know if I want to do this, because I tried to start a business when I got out of school in 2013 and had a absolutely miserable go of it. Because it was a ton of work. I had no idea how to be a business person. And I didn't know if I wanted to do that to myself again. And so ultimately I decided that's what I wanted to do. And it was a moment in time where I had to, what I say, like it was a year zero, and this is similar to teaching, is I took a year zero. It's not a first year. I'm not making strides toward anything. I'm just trying to survive and collect data, so that I have some framework in which to put that information and then manipulate that information. I can start to make strides year one. And so that year, I mean, it was, I mean, I was dealing with Instagram sponsorships. I was dealing with commissions. And nobody pays you for an Instagram sponsorship. Nobody gives a shit, right? Nobody cares about content that's not evergreen. So it was like, I had new projects like every couple of weeks, and it was just balls to the wall, make things happen, cut wood, glue it back together, figure it out as you go. And it taught me how to work fast. I'll say that it was valuable in that regard. But it was absolutely just a, I saw my bank account slowly coming down, and it was constantly the, how do I get it to stabilize? You know,
wow. I think your business was OnlyFans.
Well, that's I don't. That's not my main business, but it is my main income.
We will be discussing Eric's OnlyFans in the after show. For me, it was definitely graduate school. It was so hard. I picked the hardest lab in the whole institution, and everyone warned me, like, if you pick this lab, you know you're gonna be served. And I was like, bring it on. Little did I know it would come my way. And it was extremely difficult. My mentor was very, very hard on me, extremely demanding, to the point that it was like it almost broke me. And to her credit, she was a fantastic mentor and had the utmost integrity. So I do want to say that. And she did me a huge service, but it took a lot out of me. And I was in the lab. I was hustle and grinding in the lab for 7 years, and no, I was broke as a joke the whole time. I mean, they give you enough money to live and eat, but man, that was balls out. And then my postdoc after was pretty intense too for the next 4 years. So that's, 11 years, after college, after 4 years of college, that's 11 additional years. With Mary, as you alluded to earlier, the promise of a career, the promise of stability.
I was going to ask, like, what is the goal in that situation? Like, what's the thing that keeps driving you forward?
Well, you know, Eric, it's crazy. To do something like that, you have to be a little mental. And you have to love the topic so much that it's all you can imagine doing. And I did. I love science that much. I know I don't talk about science a whole lot, and I'm always talking about woodworking, but science is actually my first love, and that's why I do that full time. And so as much as I love woodworking, I probably love science more. And so I could do that. It was total hustle and grind, and that was my period of just total imbalance. But it needed to happen during that period, or else I wouldn't have made it through.
So I'm curious, like, you clearly have this deep love for science, and you have a deep love for many things.
Money.
Money.
All right. So this kind of gets at the point that I was driving toward is, like, we say hustle culture with our noses turned up because, you know, we know that, like, it's not the best for mental health, and it's not this, and it's not serving that, and you could do better, and you could find a job. But there is a tremendous portion of the population who don't have the opportunities that we've had, right?
Yes.
And to those folks, if you're talking about folks without a dream, without a hope, the hope that if you just fucking work hard enough, something good might happen, that is not without value.
Right.
And I don't want to lose sight of that, because we can sit in our armchairs all day long and talk about, like, well, you know, it's good to take a break, and it's good to go on vacation, and it's good to do this and that. Right. But when you only have a dream, you cling on to that with a manic obsession.
Right. Right. And the word that comes to mind as you said all that is privilege. I certainly had privilege going to college, going to a great graduate school. So, Eric, it's a great point. What if you don't have that privilege starting out? Mary, you alluded to a conversation earlier you might want to share.
Yes, yes.
I had this conversation with my dad recently, because both him and my mom are immigrants from Taiwan, and they came over. My dad grew up homeless, like more than you can imagine. Just like every time he talks about it, he's like, I was studying by like the candlelight or like the moonlight and like having to, you know, look for scraps of food and trash and things like that. Just like poor beyond what I can imagine. And coming to America was like the American dream. That was the thing to work towards. And like, to my dad's credit, he absolutely achieved that. Like he worked his way and like figured out a way to get to graduate school and through college, despite not really speaking English very well. And just like so many things that are so difficult to handle when moving to a different country. And yeah, like he talked about this, like I had to work every day. Otherwise I didn't think my family was going to survive. Like didn't even have kids at some point. Once he did have kids, he's like, I have the livelihood of my kids. Like I cannot eat, but my kids need to eat. Like I need to be able to support them. And like, if I don't hustle and grind, like what is this future that we're going to have in this country? Like we basically uprooted our entire life and have formed a different and like have adopted this other culture here. So it's very scary for him to take it. Well, nowadays he can, but like back then he's like, I could not take a day off. There's no chance that I could have taken a day off. Otherwise I would have felt like a failure. I would have felt, you know, like I'm wasting my time and my life. And I don't know. I think he says like nowadays he still has a mentality. Like he retired and he hates it because he doesn't know what to do. Like he's just worked his whole life. So now he's like, I don't really know what to do now. So I'm trying to help him like figure that out. And it's just completely unknown territory for him, but it's been his entire life of like, this is what I know. This is like who I am. I am someone who works really hard. I define myself through my work. And yeah, it's difficult.
That's a great point.
All right. So ultimately this is a woodworking podcast, right? So can we take that and put it in the context of woodworking and how we view this thing that we all love? So immediately what comes to mind is when I was working at a cabinet shop, Paul Downs Cabinet Makers in 2017 or so, there was, I want to say he was a Somali immigrant. His name was Remy. He was a super, super sweet guy. And he came in every day. He started around the same time as me, had zero experience, but he busted his ass every day. And I wonder, like, we sit here as furniture makers, as woodworkers, as designers, and we nitpick about like, oh, your proportions are a little bit off or your chamfer's a little heavy. And then we like to like, oh, well, this person's just, they're just out here making cutting boards and shit, you know? But like to somebody, the ability to make cutting boards and make money doing it is the fucking dream. You know, and it's a dream beyond their wildest hopes when they were, you know, in another country trying to pick through scraps to get by.
Apologies to anyone who makes cutting boards.
I mean, fuck your game. But my point stands. It's like there is a thing to like this may kind of circle all the way back around from like to like the craft and art argument, right? Is can you just do the thing and be happy with it and find contentment in there? Or do you need to hustle to sell some greater vision? And maybe it just is as simple as like, wherever you start in life, that next step is the great vision.
All right. So that's a very good question. Are you content with just making the thing, or is there some bigger vision that it contributes to your happiness? And that brings up one of my favorite topics ever. Oh, which is, oh, Eric, you knew this was coming. What is the best determining factor of happiness? And as a researcher, I tend to go towards research to try and figure it out because I believe data. And the Harvard study of adult development is a study that's been running for 85 years at Harvard. And they started, whatever it was, 85 years ago. And they said, we're going to follow a group of people longitudinally over their whole life. And we're going to measure everything. We're going to measure what they did for a job, whether they were healthy, whether they were married, what they, you know, did with their time. We're going to measure everything about that. And then what we're going to do is correlate it with happiness measures. We're going to ask them, do you feel happy? And why or why not? And they were trying to scientifically determine what makes people happy. And that is a hell of a study, by the way, because to run a study for 85 years, you know, the original authors who got the grant money to do that, they're dead. They're long dead. So you have to like find people to pick up that research and keep it going and keep perpetuating the grant funding, the literature cycle, the whole nine yards for 85 years. It's the longest running study of its kind anywhere. It's phenomenal that it actually, and it's still going. It's amazing. The conclusion of the Harvard study of adult development was, well, I'm going to ask you, you know, what correlates best with happiness? Was it income, a marital status, health, job, prestige, success, the amount you travel? So any guesses? I mean, there's other variables too. There's more.
Is there one answer for
everyone? I was going to say, it sounds like a multiple answer situation.
No. There was one answer and I didn't list it intentionally.
son of a bitch.
It turns out that the variable that most highly predicted and correlated. Eric, what did you just, Eric, you just whispered something to Barry. What did you just whisper?
Hey, this is a kids podcast, Paul.
We both had a similar thought.
We were both right there.
Oh my God. I'm not even going to ask. Okay. So the answer was deep, meaningful, personal relationships. That actually was more important than health, because even if you're in bad health, if you had a close network of people to support you, you felt happy in those moments. Not happy because your health is failing, but happy that you had the support. And so I always think about this when I think about balance in the shop. You know, I spend a lot of time alone in the shop and it's tough. And I do get lonely in the shop. It's like, it's always just me out there. And then, you know, last weekend, Keith Johnson joined me to work on our whiskey cabinets after he blew me off for 2 years. And it was just so... And it was so nice to have my friend. It was so nice to have my friend in the shop. And Eric, you've come by my house multiple times. And it's just such a joy to like do this thing we love with other people. And it all makes sense to me in light of that research finding.
So I'm curious about this idea of balance then, because one thing I know to be an almost absolute in our community is when we get together, we make things together. And it like, there's an idea where like, we can't not make things. It's like a compulsion, right? And so is that really balanced? Like we find a great deal of joy in it. We find a great deal of contentment in it. And we find that interpersonal relationship and sharing the experience and the object with the people that we care about. Yeah. But are we really balanced if we can't just fucking sit down and have a drink with a friend and like talk about life? Or are we just like, we need a thing to do that we can connect over, right? And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying like an observation.
Woodworking's the vehicle that connects many of us. And it's fun, right? Eric, I actually remember 3 times at least you were at my place. One time you helped me build my kitchen.
Yeah. Do you remember that? The first time I came over when Vicky was like, who's this strange dude from the internet? And I was like, don't worry, we're doing a kitchen today.
He was amazing and he helped so much. The second time I remember, you actually cut the hand cut dovetails for the whiskey cabinet that Keith blew me off for 2 years.
Oh, really? That's right. That in that cabinet.
Yeah, the cabinet that Keith blew me off for 2 years. That one. All
right. If I don't get credit on this cabinet, I'm quitting.
And then a third time, you brought that amazing violin case, and you and I cogitated over the design, how to add whatever to it, you know, accents.
And then the fourth time, we made chopsticks.
We did?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was so meaningful.
We were very drunk when we started making the chopsticks.
I don't remember that at all.
But this is what I mean. Like, this is the foundation of our friendship, is we have a shared thing that we love, and then when we hang out, we get to do it together. And that's a beautiful thing. That's not something to, like, you know, pass over and say that we're imbalanced because of it, but it does raise the question, like, every time we hang out, we're like, yeah, of course we're making things. It's what we do.
I love it. And I don't remember the chopsticks at all. But on that note, I want to ask Mary a question. So Mary, there's a way to visualize making, and this comes to Eric's point about why do we always make shit when we're together. Are you happiest when you're on the journey of making in the middle of the project, or do you get more excited about the destination when it's finished?
I feel like I can map this out because so happy when I first start, super thrilled. Like, I know I'm happy with the design, happy, pretty happy starting. And then there's always a period where it just drops from, like, everything's gone wrong. I hate this. I want to give up. Like, should I start over? I fucked up. Like, and as I get older and, like, more experience, then I can recover from that. But, like, there's always a period, and it's usually like 80% of the way through, and I'm like, I'm ready for this to be fucking over. I cannot stand this project anymore. And then at 100%, you're like, thank God. I'm so happy. And I think I'm happy mostly because it's over, but also, like, I'm pretty proud of, I mean, like, realistically, hopefully it's a good product at the end.
So how would you define, like, what's the word you would use to define that cycle you just stated? Shit show, sure. All right. So I would call that perseverance.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that's not wrong. And I think that the more experienced I get, the better I am at coming back from that low point. Like, I'm able to bounce back easier, and I'm able to know that if I just get through it, that I will be back at that, you know, that top level.
So I'm wondering, from a capitalistic, limited resource salesmanship perspective, if the difference between hustle and perseverance is you can't sell perseverance. Perseverance is a personal thing that you choose to do and have and make happen. Hustle, you can sell the dream of hustle to anybody. Gary Vee has made a career out of selling the dream to people, right? So, but they're the same thing. Like, one is just you can sell an e-course, and the other one is just a state of mind that you know through experience of doing and failing and fixing that you can get to the other side if you persevere.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I don't know what to say to that.
I'm wondering out loud.
Eric, how about you? Like, for the same question I asked Mary, like, are you happier when you're in the middle of the project, or are you, like, 100%. Elated at the end?
So this comes back to the conversation we had last time about chasing the dragon. At the beginning of my career, it was always at the very end, because you don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't have the experience to see what's in front of you. And so when you get to the end and you realize it doesn't suck, you're fucking elated, right? And it's the most magical thing. Like, I will never be as excited about a project as the blanket chest that I made when I was in school, because it was the first thing I ever designed. And I got to the end, and Alad, who was my teacher and is an incredibly gracious human being, just, like, gave me the old wink and the nod. And he was like, hey man, that's actually pretty good. And I was like, holy shit, did I just, like, succeed? But at this point, like, the succeeding at the end, for fear of sounding arrogant, I don't like, but I just assume that I will succeed at the end by the time I get, I'll figure out how to. It may take me different lengths of time, but I'll figure out how. So at this point, it is, like I talked about seeking earlier, once I get that sniff of a thing, once I get that scent and I start down that trail, that's when I get excited. Is I'm like, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know where it's going to end up, but I know I'm going down this road, and this is interesting to me at this moment.
I'm with you 100%. It used to be the destination early on, because it proved to myself I wasn't an abject failure. But then when you accept that you know how to make things, man, is that journey, like that process. It's I love the process, and the feelings of euphoria come during the process because you're like, oh, this is going to work. This idea is, it's going to work out. And you get so excited, right? And when the project's over, funny enough, it's almost disappointing. Like I sometimes I enjoy making the thing so much that when it's over, I feel like this sense of grief and loss. I know that's so weird to say.
It's like reading a book, like a really good book. And when it's over, you miss the characters a little bit. Oh,
God. You wish there was more to read about them. Yes, like, yes. God damn. And yes, you get to start over on the next story, but it takes a while to get emotionally invested into it the way you were on the last project. And that's what, you know, people ask me all the time about woodworking, you know, how do you get into it? How, what keeps you going? And it's that, I love your phrase, Eric, chasing the dragon. That that's really, it's chasing that feeling during the making that is so intoxicating that you can't not do it.
Well, I like, it's also the risk of failure, right? Like when the project is over, it's done. So there's no more risk. It's not interesting anymore. But when you're in it, like you have an idea and you catch on that thing and you go like, this could work, but I don't know if it will work just yet. And that's the exciting part.
Yeah. So funny enough, we, you know, I think a lot about the journey or the middle versus the destination a lot and because of this. And we have, Eric and I both are very fond of the philosopher and thinker, Alan Watts. And at the end of the podcast, we're going to leave you with a 4.5 minute segment of Alan Watts speaking in his own words about whether it's the destination or the dance on the way to the destination that really provides the love and the enjoyment of life. And I'm so excited to present this clip. I begged Eric and Mary to let us play it. And I contacted the Alan Watts Foundation. And I was lucky enough to actually be responded to by his son, Mark Watts, directly. And I couldn't sort of believe I was having a conversation with Mark Watts today. Graciously allowed us to actually use Alan's own recording from the 1960s talking about this issue. So I just want to put that there that at the end of the episode, we're going to have this clip that really speaks to this issue of do you enjoy the process versus the destination and his views on that whole thing.
And I will just say, this is not hyperbolic at all. This is my favorite 4 minutes on the internet. Like, hands down, across any genre, it is. I don't mean to overhype it. You can like it or not like it all you want. But for me, and Paul and I think very similarly in this regard, I know that it's the foundation of our friendship, but it has had a profound impact on the way that I approach my work, my life, and where I put my value. So there is
that. And I'd like to double down on Eric's sentiment. This clip, this type of thinking has profoundly affected how I approach my life, which is, it's crazy that both Eric and I are saying that, right? Like, what?
I mean, he's one of the great thinkers of the second half of the 20th century.
Anyway, so with that, you know, I think we covered a lot about hustle culture. It funny enough, I think the internet is like rallying against it because it's so unhealthy in the long term. But funny enough, I think we together have actually pointed out exceptions. There are times when a sprint is appropriate, or there are conditions like when you don't have privilege and you're just trying to survive when it is appropriate. It's funny, you know, it's funny to think about it, like everyone's railing against it. And I'm definitely against it in the long term, but yet there are these periods where it seems appropriate. All right, with that, let's transition to our next segment, which is feature of fail. And what we mean by fail, we were talking about this before the show. What we mean by fail is not necessarily like, oh, I fucked up my Morrison Tenon, but really like, is there something, you know, mentally that you wanted to achieve and you didn't achieve, or, you know, it could be bigger than a material thing. So I'm going to call on Mary, which is her favorite thing that I do. as she stares at me with those eyes. Mary, what is your eyes. You got a fail for us recently?
Yeah, this is like my nightmare of Paul calling on me. So like, oh god. I guess like, yeah, my quote unquote fail is not exactly a fail, but I just recently moved to Philly, and that's why Eric and I are filming in the same place. But I joined a shop that I have spent basically the last week and a half in almost every day or every night, just mentally preparing myself to be in this space. And then actually just today, I got a message from a friend of mine who is a woodworker, and we had been looking at like shop spaces together and had given up for a little bit because there were just no available spaces, but got a message from her today of like, hey, found this cool new space, happens to be in Eric's building.
Hell yeah, it does.
And you happen to live across the street from him.
She moved across the country and lives across the street from me. And now she's like, hey, I'm going to be in the shop underneath you.
I did not find the space.
Stalker much?
Oh my god.
Creeper! Creeper!
Okay. Also, I lived in Philly before you. I'm just saying.
But you didn't live here until I came here.
That's not true. I live here.
Temporally accurate from my perspective.
Oh my god. Okay. But anyway, it's not so much a fail, but more of a me being mentally, like accepting mentally that I am in this current space, but this kind of not roadblock. It's just like another, I don't know, idea and concept for me to accept that I could suddenly just be moving into another space. So it's not a fail, I guess, but in my mind, I was just so ready to be where I am right now. But this other opportunity came up, and if we do go through with it, it's too good not to go through with, to be honest.
Sounds Mary, like how about the...
Yeah.
What, say that again, Eric? What?
It sounds like an emotional fail more than anything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I'm someone who really likes to be prepared and like know what to expect. Okay.
Mary, how about the fact that you made all your shop furniture out of highly figured walnut?
Okay, that
and
was...
then complained that she doesn't have enough money to keep doing it.
That was my accident.
You know what's way cheaper than figured walnut? Literally anything else.
It was all I had, and I was like, may as well. You guys know that I like nice things. So, I mean, I guess I gotta keep going.
Absurd.
Mary's gonna go bankrupt making chisel holders.
Yeah. It's gonna be another fucking French Revolution in here in the woodworking world. The bourgeoisie of the woodworkers over here.
Oh my god.
Eric, I think in one of our previous episodes you said what did you say? Heretofore? What did you say?
Listen,
all the time.
I may be the most undereducated of the three of us, but I have a fucking vocabulary, sir. Okay.
And now you pull out bourgeoisie.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm just trying to hit our target market, okay?
It's fantastic. Eric, what's your fail besides using vocabulary?
Mostly the use of bourgeoisie. what is my fail? I would say the fail that came to mind is just content and the expectations of content. And this is more normal. It's a regular occurrence. So I don't know if I could consider it a fail per se, but it does. Anytime you think you've nailed it and you're like, this one's going to do well, an Instagram post, a TikTok post, a YouTube video, whatever it is, you're like, this one's going to do well. And then it tanks. And every time you're like, I give up, man. Like what is going on? And then inevitably it's the ones that you throw up like with no thought or foresight that just blow up and do the best. So I've had a couple of those recently where I was like, put up a YouTube video. I was like, this thing is going to pop off, man.
Which ones?
There was the Cats Moses Router video, which did well, but it didn't do as well as I had hoped. Mm-hmm. Or the video I put out last week, which was about like shop made stains and like stop using pre-made stains. It's done well in the numbers, like the views are high, but the viewer retention is very low. And so what I'm realizing in conversation with a few friends, like Drew Witt, for example, is I didn't frame the video well enough to retain attention in the long haul. So like it was a success in that like I got people to click on the video, but it was a failure in that I failed to then consider how to retain their attention.
Well, do you know?
I would have reformatted the video to basically frame it around the can of stain that was in the thumbnail and articulate why this was less than ideal and then show them a better way, right? Mm-hmm. To continue to lead and tell the story rather than just dive right into, this is what professionals do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're such a professional.
Of the three of us. Why don't you flip that bird audibly, Paul? I don't know.
I don't know what you're referring to, Eric.
You're 2-4 if you could flip that bird audibly. What's your fail, Paul? What's your fail?
My fail, yeah, I've been real bad about posting anything. Like, yeah. Real bad. And I always think of, yeah, kind of. Not that I feel a ton of pressure to post all the time, but I could be sharing more of what's going on. And I always think of Jimmy DiResta. You know, I really like Jimmy. I've met him a couple times now. He's such a great dude. And one of the things that I always remember him saying that sort of stuck in my head is like, stop over stop like censoring yourself, stop like over, you know, overdoing the videos. They don't have to be perfect. Just share what you have when you have it. And I have this thing where it's like, oh, but I know if I do this, it'll be better. And then what happens is I never do it. And I think he's right. Just share it. Share it. Share the raw reality of like whatever you're working on. And I haven't been doing that. I've been putting it off and putting it off and putting it off till I'm ready to have like a more polished product. And to me, that's a fail because I want to be more easy breezy about posting. Because I think it's good for me, you know, commission wise, and it's good for the community. Like, we all like to see what everyone's working on in real. We don't always need this polished stuff. Anyway, I've been failing in that miserably lately. So, all right,
for your mental health, buddy.
Now that we talked about our failures, let's talk about some successes, which comes in the form of a Patreon. the last episode we only had 3, and now I think we have 8. Wow, look at that growth!
Yeah.
Woo! most of the people who joined I know personally. First, we have
these people Instagram DMing, please.
It's like all my friends. We have Ron Lowe's, who actually came to my house, my shop one day. He's a great guy. I've met him twice. Good, you know, my very close personal friend who I actually are me and my wife vacation with him and his wife, John Welch, John Francis Designs. He wanted to support us. I really appreciate that, John. Vic Teslin, who I think a lot of us know from his time at Lee Valley and woodwork fine woodworking. Yeah, Vic's a great dude. I just met him and his wife, Andrea, at the last woodworking show. Nicholas Berchtold, who, as you know, uses CNC to make boobies on cutting boards and all kinds of really cool CNC textures,
really cool textures, like smooth ones, pointy ones.
Oh my God, you guys.
He makes titties on cutting boards, but he also makes like button fabric kind of textures. Really, really amazing use of CNC. And we're going to talk about CNC in a future episode and upset a lot of people, I'm sure. And then we have Chris Ortiz. So thank you, the 5 of you, for supporting us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
So with that, I think it's time for everybody's favorite.
What? Did you just call me a bitch out of nowhere? I did not know that's what was expected at that point. I thought you were just calling me a bitch for no reason.
Down here, like, taunting the bull?
I mean, you do that all the time.
You got mad at me for calling you a taint. Come on, man.
You do that all the time. It's not surprising.
It's the foundation of our friendship.
Mary, you have permission to hit his ass.
Oh, my God.
Freaking punch him.
I do our patrons. I do. Mm. I do not know I was supposed to say thank you at that point, but it's thank
not,
you.
Not very clear to our patrons.
Oh, my God.
Okay, on that note, Mary, how about you and I embarrass Eric with this slide, because we got a doozy today.
Please. Oh, yeah.
The slide. We're going to slow things down, draw a bath, pour some wine, light some candles, because we're sliding into Eric's DMs. Eggplant emoji.
Oh, slide.
I'm horny.
Oh, I just can't even wait to get into it. Are y'all ready?
Dip into it, buddy.
It's a doozy. Here we go.
Hey, Eric. Oh my God, I'm in love with you. Heart eye emoji. You are the guy of my dreams. Heart eye emoji. And although I know you will never read this, I want to tell you that I wish I could meet you at some point in my life. Star eye emoji. You are my platonic love. Upside down smiley face. I'm Colombian and I live in Houston, Texas, and I recently opened this app, which is why I don't have very many people added recently. Crying emoji. You're very handsome, and you have everything I look for in a guy. Heart eye emoji. I hope you'll do me this miracle of answering me something one day. Star eye emoji. I'm single and I don't have kids. Blessings. Prayer hands emoji.
Hit me with the blessings at the end.
That went so many different directions.
It was a novella, first of all.
Oh my God.
Oh man, there were so many emojis.
Every sentence was not what I expected.
No, every sentence was a chapter in a book.
Oh my goodness.
So thirsty.
I just love at the end. They were like, blessings. I mean, be well with the Lord.
Gotta be polite.
Por Patri Spiritu Santo. Yeah, it's great. Well, that's quite the message. Mary, get your thoughts together on that one, because you and I have some work to do in the after show talking about that. Eric, do you remember getting that one?
I don't remember that one. Sorry. I don't remember that one.
Yeah, how do you not remember that?
I want to know if it's a guy or a girl.
What's strange and concerning is that's one of the tamer ones I've received, actually. Like, there was nothing explicit in there.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, we're going to handle that in the after show. If you want to hear the after show or see the video feeds, just subscribe to our Patreon. It's that easy, and you'll have access to the YouTubes. I'd like to kind of summarize now sort of where we've been, and we're going to end on that clip that Eric and I talked about earlier. So is hustle culture detrimental? My takeaway is that in the long term, yes. Absolutely. There's just no other way to slice it. It's not good for your mental state. It's not good for your health. It's not good for the things that matter in life, according to the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which is close personal relationships. It's just very poisonous in the long term. However, that being said, there are times at which I think it is appropriate to hustle and grind, which is whether you're in grad school or whether you are not in a position of privilege and you're really struggling to make your way in this world. And in those cases, it does seem, you know, for a period of time that's what you need to do. So anyway, that's my personal summary of that today. And we're going to leave you with the words of Alan Watt, one of my favorite philosophers of all time. who's really talking about this idea of finding joy during the journey of something rather than the destination. This clip of graciously provided by the Alan Watts or alanwatts.org through his son Mark Watts.
Now, it's my contention and my personal opinion, this is my basic metaphysical axiom, shall we put it that way, that existence, the physical universe, is basically playful. There is no necessity for it whatsoever. It isn't going anywhere. That is to say, it doesn't have some destination that it ought to arrive at. But that it is best understood by analogy with music. Because music, as an art form, is essentially playful. We say you play the piano. You don't work the piano. Why? Music differs from, say, travel. When you travel, you are trying to get somewhere. And of course, we, because being a very compulsive and purposive culture, are busy getting everywhere faster and faster and faster till we eliminate the distance between places. I mean, with the modern jet travel, you can arrive almost instantaneously. And what happens as a result of that is that the two ends of your journey become the same place. So you eliminate the distance, and you eliminate the journey. Because the fun of the journey is to travel, not to obliterate traveling. So then, in music, though, one doesn't make the end of a composition the point of the composition. If that were so, the best conductors would be those who played fastest. And there would be composers who wrote only finales. People go to a concert just to hear one crashing chord, because that's the end. Same way in dancing. You don't aim at a particular spot in the room. That's where you should arrive. The whole point of the dancing is the dance. Now, but we don't see that as something brought by our education into our everyday conduct. We've got a system of schooling which gives a completely different impression. It's all graded. And what we do is we put the child into the corridor of this grade system with a kind of, come on, kitty, kitty, kitty. And yeah, you go to kindergarten, you know, and that's a great thing because when you finish that, you'll get into first grade. And then, come on, first grade leads to second grade and so on, and then you get out of grade school and you go to high school and it's revving up, the thing is coming. Then you're going to go to college, and by Jove, then you get into graduate school, and when you're through with graduate school, you go out to join the world. And then you get into some racket where you're selling insurance. And they've got that quota to make. And you're going to make that. And all the time, this thing is coming. It's coming. It's coming. That great thing, the success you're working for. Then when you wake up one day about 40 years old, you say, my God, I've arrived. I'm there. And you don't feel very different from what you always felt. And there's a slight letdown because you feel there's a hoax. And there was a hoax. A dreadful hoax. They made you miss everything. By expectation. Look at the people who live to retire and put those savings away. And then when they're 65, they don't have any energy left, they're more or less impotent, and they go and rot in an old people's senior citizens community. Because we've simply cheated ourselves the whole way down the line. We thought of life by analogy with a journey, with a pilgrimage, which had a serious purpose at the end, and the thing was to get to that end, success or whatever it is, or maybe heaven after you're dead. But we missed the point the whole way along. It was a musical thing, and you were supposed to sing or to dance while the music was being played.